Hello and welcome to Madecast.
This series is brought to you by HCMA Architecture and Design. I'm your co-host, Stephanie Pollock.
And I'm your other co-host, Cody Johnston. This is Edmonton's Design Podcast, produced by MADE. MADE respectfully acknowledges that we are located on Treaty 6 territory, a traditional gathering place for diverse Indigenous peoples whose histories, languages, and cultures continue to influence our vibrant community, including the Cree, Blackfoot, Métis, Nakota Sioux, Iroquois, Dene, Ojibwe, Salto, Anishinaabe, Inuit, and many others.
This is the fourth episode in our series. I'd like to say a quick thank you to our sponsors, HCMA, RPK Architects, and GEC Architecture. In this week's episode, episode 4, titled Preservation and Reimagining Historic Buildings, we have with us Croy Johnston and Dane Reichson. Croy Johnston is a graduate of the Urban and Regional Planning Program at the University of Alberta, working at Beljaan Developments. He's a Northside boy just like myself, and Beljaan Developments has played an integral role in reimagining our city through projects like the Oliver Exchange Building, which repurposed the 1913 West End Telephone Exchange, and other projects, like White Ave Strathcona Hotel. Dane Reichson is a history student at the University of Alberta. Dane piqued our interest with his stellar eye for photography and a masterful online presence. Check out that work at ForgottenEdmonton.com and on Instagram at CitizenDane.
In this week's episode, we discuss the preservation of historic buildings, inspiring community cultural history through social media, and how Beljaan Developments is approaching revitalization projects, adaptation versus demolition, as well as Citizen Dane's modern take on making history fun again through social media.
So today in episode 4, we have with us Croy Johnston from Beljaan Developments and
Dane Reichson,
who is a University of Alberta student in the history department. And yeah, we want to explore how we can utilize our existing infrastructure, save it, modify it, and in any other way, make it good, make it useful, make it exciting again. And if our digital relationships with each other and our buildings have changed, and if they will change the built environment. So real quick, we'd like to get an introduction going for each of you. I won't try to introduce you because you know yourselves better than me. So why don't we start with Croy? Give us a quick intro to who you are and what you're up to.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, Cody. Croy Johnston with Beljaan Development. My background's in urban planning, but I've been working with Beljaan Development for 3.5 years now. Beljaan is a local boutique developer in Edmonton, Alberta. We specialize in doing historical retrofits or just retrofits of small, medium, or large scale. We find great pride in doing these types of projects just to continue the life cycle of the building and just give it a new life and really reimagine it. I think it takes creative minds to do that, and we really enjoy it. But that being said, we also do a lot of conventional projects, and I mean, we try to make them a bit more stand out and kind of push the edge of what conventional is and really make it the standard, because I think our mandate and our ethos at Beljaan is to make Edmonton better, or just the cities that we live in better. I think we have the ability to do that with building and developing and going from there.
Great. So Dane, why don't you give us a little introduction to who you are and what things you're doing around the city?
I'm Dane Reichson. As mentioned, I'm a history student with the University of Alberta. I'm a part-time local historian and serve with the Edmonton Historical Board's Historic Resource Review Panel. I do a lot of photography and writing in my spare time and try and uncover the history of Edmonton's heritage buildings, and I share them online to a decent sized following, I guess.
Nice. Yeah, I forgot to mention that I'm here today also with my co-host, Stephanie Pollock. So Stephanie, do you have something to ask them to start things off?
You bet I do. So I guess I'd kind of like to start off by just talking about redevelopment in general a little bit, just to share with our audience what that means to the city of Edmonton. And so, Croy, could you share with us a little bit your experience with redevelopment and like the positive change you've seen redeveloping something, or even some of the struggles with it?
Of course. Yeah, no, great question. Redevelopment, obviously, it's basically taking an existing building and adding new components, bringing it to the level of building code that it needs to be. And then also just taking maybe an underutilized or derelict asset and making it more profitable. So we've done that with multiple buildings. I mean, there's a historical retrofit process where it takes into a lot of the historical characteristics and maintaining it and trying to continue it. But then there's also retrofits that are taking buildings that may, like I said, are a bit derelict, underutilized, and just giving them a new life and making them more profitable for investors, us, the developers, or even the tenants that want to use these spaces. I mean, lots of positives because you're getting a lot of these buildings that are in desirable places, but they just need that TLC or that extra boost to become marketable and usable. But for challenges, I mean, it's one of those things in the financing world or in the investing standpoint that sometimes they are considered a bit more risky because it is not a conventional type of development. So it's a bit tough, or for the financiers, they don't see maybe the value in the end game, or they find it a bit hard to finance. So obviously there's challenges in that aspect. But in a tangible sense, when you're redeveloping something that is a bit older, there was building practices done way before that are not acceptable in today's standards. So now you're remediating asbestos, just materials that aren't like are not good, and we need to change. So there's definitely a cost implication to that, as well as they're not easy to design for because you have to take into considerations the existing structure. You don't want to take too much things or the infrastructure out, because then it's basically a new building at that point, which is fine in some circumstances and it needs to be, but lots of challenges. And it's a bit hard. I mean, to say the least, because you're taking something from an old standard and bringing it to a new standard. So costs, financing, and I think generally just I feel like it's been done throughout the world for a long time, but in Canada or in Edmonton, a lot of people have not done historical retrofits or retrofits of many kinds, so it's a bit new and people are a bit reluctant to maybe sympathize or help people out to do those new projects because it is risky.
So, there are a lot of unknowns, so it's hard to predict those unknowns.
Of course.
Yeah,
that's the funnest part of the projects, is navigating all the issues that you don't see until it's too late. So Dane, when Croy is talking about taking an old building and reusing it, what's your gut reaction? Like, do you, as somebody who does a really good job of documenting the history that we have and, you know, bringing to light what we have, yeah, what would you say, what's your gut reaction? And do you have any, I guess, opinions about good or bad executions of preservation like that?
I guess there's like a sliding scale where you have developers like Belgian that do a really good job, and then you have like Joe Schmo who's just restoring, or like quote unquote restoring his old home, and it's just like he uses like cheap stuff from like Home Depot to like vinyl siding, like plastic windows and stuff, and it's just like all the character is essentially destroyed. For me, yeah, like I said, there's like a sliding scale, and you have good and bad, and the people who tend to do heritage renovations in the city tend to do a pretty decent job for the most part.
What are your feelings when you see a building getting reused? You know, it's obviously better than demolition, But have you, what would you say to like watch out for someone like Beljan? Like please don't do that. Like, it's not, is it just about preserving the brick on the outside, or is it about more than that?
In some instances, I'd say like some buildings are kind of tied like completely to what they were originally meant for. So like, say the Princess Theater on White Avenue, right? Like if that was like, if that was up for sale and somebody bought it and they were going to like redevelop it, and they were just going to change it into like, you know, offices and like just shops. It's like the whole, not the whole, but a large chunk of that building's worth is its worth as like a historic theater building. And changing it to something else can kind of destroy a significant chunk of that worth. But yeah, like you said, on the whole, I think having adaptive reuse, because, and accepting the fact that sometimes like buildings are organic things and they change over time, and you need to sometimes come to terms with the fact that it will change to meet, basically to survive for future generations, I think is something that needs to be taken into consideration as well.
Yeah, it's you know, when I think of Beljan's work, I think of the couple of recent things where they were turning an infrastructure building into obviously a non-infrastructure mm-hmm. building, like Substation 600 now on 124th Street is the most recent. Yeah, I guess, what do you look for, Croy, in an old building, or what do you tend to avoid in an old building? Like if you look at certain old buildings, like I know the U of A ring houses were up on the chopping block, a lot harder to work with, a lot of mandates and stuff like that. But yeah, something about the Oliver Exchange building as an old TELUS building, and then the substation obviously piqued your guys' interest. So what are you guys looking for in terms of preservation?
Yeah, no, I think obviously the historical aspect is very important to us, but I also think location is a huge factor when making these decisions for these types of projects. For example, Oliver Exchange, like you mentioned, was an old telephone exchange building in the Oliver community. This was kind of before my time, but I know speaking with Ivan and just the other others on the team that like Oliver really didn't have, or it didn't seem like it had like a community hub, somewhere where the members or the community members could go and congregate and just have a space to live and enjoy themselves. So I think that was one of the factors of really retrofitting that old telephone exchange building into a community hub that has a bakery, a cafe, a retail use that all the community people and Edmontonians can use and enjoy. And then as well as for substation, I mean, the historical character, I mean, that's just a positive, but the street itself, 124th Street, it has such a vibe to it. And I think it's an up and coming street that a lot of people enjoy and have enjoyed for many years, but it's only growing, and it's becoming a place where people want to live and want to go out for drinks or buy a suit or a tie. So I think location is very important when we're making decisions. But for character, I mean, it all starts with a story. And I think the stories that were told at Oliver Exchange or substation, I mean, they're great, and you can just add to that is I think is kind of what we look for at like an interesting story. Making something, like you said, an infrastructure building into a pub, I mean, you see that often throughout the world or in Australia or London, etc. But to bring it to Edmonton and have such a local context is important to us as well.
So I want to ask, like, in regards to character, what does that mean to you? And for the places that you're choosing redevelopment, are you trying to define character, or are you trying to just enliven the existing character that's in that community? And then Dane, I'd like you to comment on that from a picture point of view as well.
Yeah, totally. Like, I mean, in some of the buildings, like the historical buildings, there's obviously like an existing urban fabric that you have to be sensitive to. But you still want to establish a new characteristic to that building, because I think a lot of these buildings that we've redeveloped, like Oliver Exchange, like Substation, and even some on White Ave, maybe not Strathcona Hotel, but they didn't have any character elements to them. I mean, in a historical perception, they did. I mean, they had the nice brick, the lintels, the Art Deco design, but they didn't have like a social character to them. So you have to really establish that. And sometimes that's a bit difficult because, like, in the world of development and real estate, like, you don't necessarily know who's going to come to the plate. But mm-hmm. when we develop these types of buildings, I think the people that we want are very attracted to these buildings because they have such a local character, and local groups want local character. So it just brings them, and it makes the leasing process a bit easier. And you also have groups that are a bit more hip and want to kind of push the boundaries as well. So they're willing to take the chance on some of these buildings. And I think, yeah, like I said, like, character is defined in a cultural or in a historic aspect, but in a social, maybe cultural context, you kind of have to establish yourself, but you have to be careful of what you're establishing.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Dane?
I kind of agree. Like, for me, there's two types of character, and it's like the historic, like, architectural character of a building, and then also the social character. And for me, what's neat about heritage buildings is that they can reflect, like, the neighborhood or the nature of the area they're in, just kind of through their existence. Like, you look at, old home in Oliver or somewhere, and it's like, it's a tiny little home amongst all these, like, high rises, right? And it's like that by its mere existence is like a reflection of the character of the neighborhood as it once was, and the history of where it's like where the city's grown up from. It's harder to know if you don't, like, pay attention to these things, but, like, even researching these buildings, it's interesting to see kind of how they're a reflection of the areas they're in, because, like, if you were to research a building, like, an old home in North Edmonton or somewhere, like, invariably you'd come up with, like every second tenant would be a meat packer or, like, a slaughterhouse worker or, like, a stockyards person. And it's interesting to see how just kind of the stories these buildings encompass and how, like I said, they're like a broader reflection of the area as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's going to be key when people think about that. It's sort of what is there and then what was, because you raise a good point. I mean, I'm thinking about the North Side. I'm from the North Side. And I know when I talk about me or my partner's grandparents, half of them worked for the Canada Meat Packers, mm-hmm. which is now just a pig stack and a bus barn, you know? So there's a ton of heritage embedded in our culture. And I mean, the building's gone, but the pig stack is there as a reminder. And so it's, even if there's just a small little remnant, I think it's actually quite impactful and makes us feel proud of where we are, because it's like, oh, my grandfather did that. And, you know, he probably hated it. It was probably like a really crappy job packing meat like that. But for us, it's like this glorified thing now, because it's a sense of place. It's our kind of thing. I lived in Oliver in the building that's called the Grindley Suites, which is basically a nondescript building. It's right across the street from the Oliver Exchange building. And it's, you know, like, yeah, from a preservation standpoint, it's not fancy or beautiful. I mean, there's much better similarly aged brick buildings on the same street. But the great thing about the Grindley Suites when I lived there was just even talking to the building owner, talking about the history of it and how it was, I don't know if it was a mayor or a counselor from like 1912 who built it. And then sometime in the 40s, it turned into, I don't know if it was the 40s, it turned into a hotel. And then like the 60s, it turned into apartments. And there's just like all these ways of this building being chopped up inside. And then you still have like this grand entryway inside where there's like these really old wooden historic elements. And then there's these modern drywall pieces that chop it up into apartments. And, you know, it doesn't look like much from the outside, but even that makes us feel proud to live there, because, you know, it's got a history and you know that we didn't tear it down. And yeah, it fits into the fabric in one way or another. So, but I was curious about, and I guess Croy, we'll just start with you, I guess. I think about, we've been talking on this podcast lately about trends and trendiness associated with social media and the instantaneous nature of our communications these days and how trends come and go so much faster and they're so much more visible to people right away. So how does Beljan, or how does anybody, balance trendiness, making it hip and cool, but also not doing something that you need to tear down in 5 years because it's out of trend now? So for Beljan, how do you balance being on trend and also preserving?
Yeah. I find that to be a really difficult question, because I think just the built environment is built on trendiness and fads, and it has been forever. I mean, we look at modernism, postmodernism, brutalism, that has all gone through a time frame of how many years. So there's definitely trends that emerge throughout our lives and existence and when we're planning these buildings. But you can plan for the future, but we don't know what the future holds. But with that being said, I mean, we try to look, and when we're planning these buildings, we want to develop something that people can use for 100 years. I mean, I think I've said that multiple times. We want people to make you like useful, have these buildings to be useful and meaningful for them and the communities for a long time. It's hard to plan for 30 years from now. But that being said, I mean, I think what we're doing in terms of maybe specific design things, we want timeless character, character that maybe can be retrofitted in the future or changed. It's a bit of a difficult question, just because trends, it's so hard to assume what the next trend's going to be. And if you do know what the next trend is going to be, you're going to be a millionaire or rich or something. But I think what we do is we just try to plan for what people will like in the next 5 years and for the future. I think a lot of the trends that emerge, obviously they're different, but they have very similar contexts of what they like. I think historical districts have always been trendy. I think we see a lot of the urban form, or a lot of the big, like where big municipalities grow from, are from those urban districts. I mean, from White Ave to, I think, Bay Street on Toronto, like they all have that heritage component that have always been trendy in a sense. And at the time of development, when you're planning it, you have to bring it to a standard that is acceptable for today's world or today's society. Difficult one. Looking to hear Dane's response or even your guys' response on that one, because I think trends are a difficult thing to assume, I guess.
Yeah, you can't predict the future, and you have to be trendy to get clients. You have to be trendy to get, you know, people leasing the spaces, obviously. But Dane, do you think there's a risk in facilitating trends when you're also preserving?
Yeah, I think so, because you'll have like an inherent clash of like something that's like 130 years old, right, and then something that's like brand new. But that's not always a bad thing necessarily either. Like I know. Like Croy might be able to go into this a bit more, but like I know that like the National Heritage Guidelines basically kind of advocate for that, like to have, like if you're going to put an addition onto a protected heritage building, to have the heritage building be its own thing and then have the addition be its own thing. And so they're kind of encouraging trendiness in that way, because you want each section to stand as its own and represent the growth of this building over its lifespan, right?
That makes me think of like the Dent Farm addition.
That's a good example.
Big modern, and like the Lee Marchand mansion has mm-hmm. some glass stuff on the back, which is very evidently different, which I think architecturally, I know I appreciate that, because it's not like somebody's trying to be.
Yeah, I don't even know if you could like nowadays, like if there's even like the craftsmen who could even like replicate these things, even if you wanted to, like, so that might be a reason for that as well. I'm not sure, but it's definitely interesting.
I want to jump in there as well. And I think, Cody, you could appreciate this, or you can attest to this, or even Dane, but like redoing cultural or heritage buildings, it just seems sometimes it's like facadism. People are just putting them up to look like these historical buildings, but they don't have the character or the timeline that these actual historical buildings have. And I think it's really important to, you have to juxtapose the historical characteristics with modern elements, things that are trendy now, and to showcase the life of that development and how it has progressed. So maybe if when we're older, when I'm 60 or whatever, I can see a building that was built in the 1920s, but then it went through an interior retrofit. It still maintained that exterior facade that was important and impactful of that time. And then you look over and there's a modern addition that people are, oh yeah, that was built in 2020. And these are the elements. And that then would be historical in some nature.
Yeah, like to build off of that, yeah, like, and to the point you had mentioned earlier, Cody, like, with the apartments you'd lived in, like, this isn't something new either. Like, over the last 130, 40 years, like, new additions have come and gone, and they're always defined by the style of their day, right? It's not like adding a glass addition is kind of just the newest, like, form of, like, putting stucco over brick or taking off wood siding or, you know, stuff like that. It's just kind of that continuation. Like even something like the El Mirador, which was just demolished, like that was like an old like 1912 craftsman home, and then they put a big Spanish style addition on the front of it. It's just like, yeah, it's just a continuation of that kind of thought.
Well, it's continuous until they demolish it.
Yeah.
I mean, design is inherently reflective of the times, like through anything, technology, design, buildings, cars. I don't know if you guys have ever watched The Crown, but there's this one episode where the sister moves into her own apartment, and so she has like all these very like classical elements, and then has like mid-century modern furniture just sitting like in the middle of everything. So like, I know we're talking about buildings and exterior, but I mean interiors do the same thing as well. Mm-hmm. They mix and match and yeah, show the wants of the times, I guess, is what I'm saying. Do you find that Edmontonians, our values align with the image of what we're creating with these developments or saving homes? Do you too find that it's like a very niche group of people who are passionate about these projects? Or do you think it's the public in general is like going along with the, not this new idea, but maybe this like movement?
I'd say it's kind of like half and half. I think the people who are interested either in like in an advocacy role is of protecting these buildings, or people like Belgian who do like in like actively restore these buildings. I think that's an inherently small group, but I think like your average Edmontonian more broadly appreciates that kind of thing, because you always see comments and stuff like, not that you should ever read like the comments on a news website or anything, but or like Facebook or whatever, but like you always see people whenever there's some story of like, oh, heritage buildings threatened, which seems to happen like every month, you always get people who are like, oh, this is typical Edmonton, oh, nobody here cares. And so it's obvious that there's a healthy group of people out there who want to see these things preserved, but I think of that there's a smaller group who actually, I don't want to say put in the effort, because that sounds like grandiose or pretentious or something, but who do kind of like go the extra step and either advocate or actually protect these buildings through restoration or reuse.
Croy, you mentioned London and Toronto. Is there anything Edmonton specific to the way Belgian is doing these redevelopments, or is the issue is doing it period versus doing it our way? Like, do you find you have the flexibility to do it in an Edmonton way yet, or is it just making it happen because we believe it's the right thing?
There, I feel like there's definitely an Edmonton way of doing things. I think it kind of is in the interiors and the landscape around us. Obviously, there's principles that you can take from the Torontos, the Londons, the Sydneys of the world. But you definitely have to plan for it in an Edmonton context, because Edmonton isn't the Londons of the world. People love their cars. People like to watch TV and their hockey games and drink beers. So you have to plan for that, and you have to acknowledge that there are differences. I couldn't specifically tell you how we develop for Edmonton, but I must say that the core of our group are all Edmontonians. We all were born here and grew up here. We know what what Edmonton likes, and I think we show or showcase what an Edmontonian is and what a passionate Edmontonian would do in terms of, like what Dane said. I think there are individuals who really push those boundaries and try to preserve and know about the culture and the historic assets. But then I would also say that there's a lot of people that may not be involved in the architecture, media, and design scene, or even the development scene, that still acknowledge that White Ave is a historical district. I mean, you can see it. You can see the historical elements. And my mom and dad, who are not in architecture or are in that scene, they still know that White Ave was always the place to go for drinks or that cultural scene or that place. So I think these historical districts have always been places, and that's not just Edmonton focus, but just everywhere. People kind of look towards those established places. So,
well, I think it's probably a hard question to answer about how are we redeveloping it in an Edmonton way. I mean, yeah, as Dane mentioned, the Edmonton way might be tearing it down, but just preserving the building helps people understand what Edmonton is or was and can be. So I know, Dane, your preservation stuff is sort of a pet project at the moment. You know, you're doing a lot of homework and a lot of recording, photography, and writing about preservation. Do you think that social media and the new ways of communicating have changed the way we think about preservation? Is it more obvious now, or is it easier to just flick through modern cool designs at the same time as preservation and not really think of preservation as a need?
I think social media has definitely helped push preservation forward. Like I had mentioned, like there's definitely, it seems like there's more of an appetite now for trying to preserve buildings, or at least like keep elements of them around. And I think a large part of that's due in part just to like even like news reporting. You see, at least I have in the last 10 years, just more and more news stories about threatened buildings, and always there'll be people who come on, like they'll interview people and about, sorry, I'm tripping over my own words here. They'll always interview people like the preservationists, and like even a couple years ago, that was like, that would rarely happen. So it's, and I think a large part of that is due to social media, because like it just gets the word out there. I remember earlier this year, I think in January, Hangar 11, which is like an old Air Force hangar on the Blatchford Field grounds, that was threatened with demolition, and there was quite a lot of media frenzy online about it. And that ended up getting saved at the last second because the word got out there about it. And stuff like the ring houses on the university campus, you mentioned them earlier. That's like a less than ideal situation, but somebody's come forward because of all the attention that the news has generated with that, has come forward to disassemble them and reassemble them somewhere else. And yeah, I think it's done a lot to get the word out there. I also think, like you had mentioned, trends and stuff, and I do think there's, and like it, this kind of ties back into the last point about like White Avenue being hip and stuff. I think there's like just through Instagram and stuff, there's kind of more of an appreciation of like using like old buildings as kind of like set dressing for photography, like to photograph yourself against something like just some nice ornate building, like as vain as that is, like I definitely think that that's helped too. Like it's just like got a broader appreciation, I guess.
Croy, when you guys are developing, do you think about that? Do you think of this would be an Instagrammable wall? This would be an Instagrammable spot when you're designing things? I mean, that might be the driver. Like, I mean, if Dane's work is saying, here's the easy, accessible digital world for people that can't go out and experience the world, but here's how you can see what Edmonton has and here's what we can preserve. But maybe Beljan's job is to actually bring people into those spaces. And so do you think the social media and the hashtagging of our world these days seeps into what Beljan tries to do with developments?
Yeah, I would say so. I think, like Dane said, I think there's a broader appreciation for just architecture, design, and those modern elements. Maybe if people aren't thinking about it, they're still in these buildings, they're still taking pictures of these buildings. And that's a shift in society. People are still enjoying the buildings. It might be different than how you and I appreciate them, but they're still enjoying them. I'd also say that social media has brought more social awareness to just many topics, and for the good and the bad. But I would say, yeah, like I wouldn't say it's the biggest factor when we're planning these developments, but it's definitely something that comes in conversation more often than not, saying, people are going to take pictures by this wall. Why don't we do like a cool mural or something that people can use for social media? I mean, it is free marketing at its finest. We don't need to do these extensive campaign or marketing campaigns to showcase these buildings. People are showcasing themselves if we can provide that ornate detail that people enjoy and really want to use. So I would say we don't build our developments around those Instagrammable spots, but we do think about how we can add cool aspects or details that people will enjoy.
Yeah.
I'll be vain for a moment. And well, I guess maybe not vain, but yeah, like my husband and I got our wedding photos in front of graffiti, and like people look at them and they're like, oh, I know where that is. Or so, I mean, it can be for something as simple as that, and we'll have those photos forever, but it'll live on too, even if it's not like an intentional thing. It might even happen by accident. But it does, like for me, that it gives me a sense of place and a sense of like memory.
Yeah, totally. I would say that like it's just easy placemaking. When you're doing or adding these details, people may not know that it's Oliver Exchange, but they know that it's the cool building with bricks that they can take pictures in front of, or Strathcona Hotel. Like that's where they used to drink in high school or in university. So it's just easy placemaking, and providing that or enhancing that is, I think, it is part of our jobs as developers and designers to acknowledge, but not design just around those things, because trends change, like we were talking about, and what the premise of the conversation is. We can't be designing just for that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, Dane, this is probably in your wheelhouse. Do you think that the discourse around preservation has changed with social media? I know you mentioned that, like, yeah, more people are aware of it, but is there an opportunity for meaningful discourse around preservation on spaces like social media? Or, I mean, we're all younger here in this chat, so like Discords or like TikTok, I mean, are these places to have those meaningful discussions, or is the mere fact of getting the image out there and saying, here's the history, good enough?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I'd say the latter, maybe, that just getting the word out there does a lot. And I don't know if social media has really yet done like what you were saying. Like, I don't think there's been that push yet that it's really like on TikTok or Discord or anything, like that's really done much to save any buildings yet. I know Facebook has, but I know that's kind of like a haven for like older technologically savvy people now. But
well, that's maybe a good commentary on it. Like typically preservation folks have been the older people in our societies, and is social media now saying, hey, it's hip and cool? Well, it's not necessarily.
Yeah,
cool,
no, but I definitely think so. If social media has done one thing, it's kind of democratized like local heritage, if that makes any sense. Like I think previously that was kind of the realm of people who actually lived through, like especially in a young city like Edmonton, who you know have been alive for 80 years of its like 100 some year history as a city, right? Like I definitely think that previously it was just in the boathouse of people who had lived through that and just kind of knew stuff just like through cultural osmosis or whatever. And yeah, social media has kind of brought that, like I'm only 24, so like it's obviously brought, but then again, I'm kind of a weird nerd recluse type person, but like definitely there's like a younger subset of people who seem to be interested in it now. And I don't think that would have been the case even 20 years ago when there just wasn't like, and this is something more broader too, but even like the digitization of like, of just old books or newspaper articles or stuff like that. Like it's easy for anybody nowadays to just research the history of their home if they wanted to and see like, oh, okay. And that like the U of A, for example, it has like old, they're called Henderson directories, and it's like a list of every Edmontonian every year. And so you can go through and find your address and search up like, okay, Billy Bob lived here in like 1920 or whatever, and this is what he did as his job. And even yeah, the digitization of resources like that have done a pretty good job, I think, making like just history more broadly accessible to people.
I'm going to jump in there, and to your point, Cody, and Dane as well, I think social media can be a discourse for heritage preservation in general. But I also think that it can do a really good job of intersecting different disciplines together. We've talked a lot about cultural and historic preservation, but there's like another aspect. And I feel like environmental preservation in these buildings is such an important topic that sometimes gets left out in the conversation. Allowing or saying these types of talking about preservation in a historical, cultural, social, environmentalist perspective will really cross people's interests and what they're passionate about together. I mean, there's some people that are super passionate about the environment that may not really enjoy the historical preservation side of it, but there is so many facets and so many conversations to be had with preservation that I think social media can really blend that together and allow for that discourse to happen between groups or cliques that may not have those conversations.
Yeah, like this is kind of getting off on a tangent a bit, but I think the point about like eco-preservation, if you want to call it, that's like a really good one that, like I said, like even 20 years ago, I don't think would have been in the discussion at all. And it's something you see brought up more and more frequently online about the reason for saving these buildings. Like there's a saying that always gets passed around, and it's like the greenest building is one already built. And it's because, yeah, these buildings embody so much like carbon and just like, I don't want to say unrecyclable materials, but you know, like they have like these giant like oak trees or whatever were cut down to make like floorboards and stuff for them. And it's stuff that's like, yeah, to save buildings is to save these kind of precious resources and help just, yeah, keep a good like environmental footprint.
Yeah, taking in the life cycle of these buildings, I think is super important. And something, like I said, like something that typically isn't talked about in cultural or historic preservation, but it should be, because we're really, we're hitting a lot of check boxes all in one building. And I think we can get a lot of people behind that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I know this is sort of niche market architectural, but yeah, I know there are words like, you know, deep energy retrofits, you know, those are big words that are coming out these days. And some of the things, you know, I know like Botterwick Construction, they've done some things in Riverdale with Sundance Co-op, and their thing was putting extra insulation on the outside of the building. And so it, not in a way of preserving the character in any way at all, really, but in a way of cultural and community preservation, is saying this building has been good here, so let's preserve this building and make it net zero. And then there's things like the passive house, you know, like energy retrofits, where you go in and bring this old building that is probably just a brick wall with no insulation, and you put the insulation on the inside or whatever, and in some way to make these buildings green. Now we have to cover up some of that character, and we have to make that choice if we're going to cover it up on the outside with the insulation, or if we have to cover it up on the inside with insulation and drywall and et cetera. So those are the questions that I think are going to be really important moving ahead, is how do we use our technology, not so much social media, but different types of architectural technology, insulations and whatever, to sensibly preserve these buildings' character and not just cover all up in an effort to be green. Although I think we can all appreciate green efforts. You know, all of us, I think all our generation is more, that's a matter of fact. It's not a question anymore. That's something we need to do. So it'd be interesting to see how people do that moving ahead. And I think BelGen has had to address those issues. And, you know, it is definitely a trade-off of saying, okay, we think the character is more important here, so we're going to relax the energy goals and we'll pay a little bit more on energy, I guess, for the sake of preserving this building for the cultural region. So are there any digital tools, new modern tools that BelGen is utilizing for all this kind of stuff? Like, I think of like point clouds. You know, I'm actually currently with RPK Architects working to preserve the Prince of Wales Armory building. One of the turrets is kind of falling off, and we're kind of working on preserving it. And yeah, there's brick repointing, and we did a point cloud and stuff like that. So I'm wondering, are there tools that you're using right now with BelGen, or is there other tools that you think might be useful in the future? Or is that just in the architect's wheelhouse? You're two steps removed.
That I think that really comes into the architecture and the consultant's wheelhouse, like you mentioned. We really just come up with, I mean, the general idea and kind of do the background and the other stuff. And then the architects and the consultants really do those tangible items. In terms of software, like I think we're seeing a prevalence in architecture with lots of BIM modeling. I think just making and finding efficiencies in the design standpoint is really helpful on a development lens, because time is money. I mean, we can't be taking tons of time to develop and design these buildings because we have interest costs. We have a lot of costs throughout the whole development. And if we can find a tool or software that shortens that timeline or makes that collaboration or that design more efficient, I think we'd be all for it. And we really push the consultants and the architects to continue to use those types of softwares. So I would say, in short, that it really comes on the onus of the architects and the consultants to use it. But we do like to see these parties using those features, because it does help us in the long run. So yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess leave that portion to the archy nerds and the building science people for sure. Do you see any, I mean, maybe social media is the biggest digital tool in preservation, but do you see any benefits of digital technologies and preservation? I mean, I think of like going down to the Prince of Wales Armory, and that's where you can see a lot of Edmonton's archives, you know. I don't know, do you see anything digitally, technology-wise, that's enhances people's ability to preserve, understand preservation?
Yeah, definitely. I think just the ability to digitize information and just make it more accessible, like information accessibility is so important in today's society, and those technologies have made that possible. People that may not have the ability to go to the archives or go to university, etc., now have the ability to Google something and find out those facts. I think just the ability to showcase what preservation is and all its standpoints is super important. And having that technology to make it more accessible, I think is very important. I can't think of like a specific tool, but just having the ability for others, not others, but people to get that information is very important because, I mean, as we expand as a society, like opinions and technologies and things come out because of people knowing information and just allowing that broad idea and the ability to make your own opinions is really important, I think.
Yeah. What about you, Dane? Do you see anything moving ahead that'll make preservation easier and more accessible?
Yeah, like I had mentioned, like the digitization of old directories or newspapers, I think has done a lot because it's given just regular people, like you had said, like this kind of research was the realm of nerds for a long time, or like I had mentioned, just like old people, or older people. And yeah, I think the ability just to, you know, obviously you need to know where to look for these things, but if you can find it, like you can go to the University of Alberta's Peel Prairie Provinces collection online, and they have collections of about 100 different Alberta newspapers from the 1880s to like the 1960s, and you can just start researching whatever you want. And I think it's done a good job, just letting regular people be able to get a better appreciation for things that might not or might have been out of reach previously.
So yeah. For anyone who's listening, if we have any young listeners that, you know, really align with what both of you are saying, or they, you know, feel really passionate about saving old buildings, what can they do moving ahead? What, like, is there anything they can be a part of, or where do either of you suggest that they go to, or information they can look at?
Yeah, I would say just keep listening to these types of podcasts. Really research your local developers, architects, people that really go into these kind of details and are passionate about those things. Reach out to them and talk to them about your opinions and your thoughts. And even if it's a quick email about like what you think you could do with a building or your thoughts, I think it goes a long way. And I think also just general research, and if you're passionate about it or just have a general interest, just read some topics and have those talking points that you can talk about with your friends or your colleagues or your schoolmates that may have general interests or maybe not. And maybe you can educate them on new things about Edmonton or preservation and the benefits or the negatives of it. And, yeah, I think just having the ability and being curious of what is next and making your own opinions is very important. And you can make your own opinions by doing your own research and being curious as well. I think that's super important.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think keeping an open mind and trying to just put in just even like the tiniest bit of effort will get you... can do a lot. Even just like looking at like the Edmonton Historical Board, for instance, has a website called Edmonton's Architectural Heritage, and you can go there and you can read up on different buildings around the city and their histories. I know the City of Edmonton, their website has 3 walking tours that, and they're just like PDF pamphlets of downtown Old Strathcona and the Highlands, and you can use those and walk around, and they give about a paragraph blurb of like 30 or 40 different buildings in those areas each. Yeah, just things like that, just learning about the history around you, even if it's just a tiny paragraph blurb like that, like, goes a long way to help, I think, understanding, like, the history of the city and what the kind of current state of its heritage preservation, and what, and from there you can kind of figure out like what you could do to try and help.
That's great. Thank you both for that.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because a lot of it is, even though it's more accessible now, a lot of people might not take the time to go and learn the history for themselves. But as long as there's somebody trying to, you know, I know there's always that guy out on White Ave yelling, preaching to people about whatever, and we don't necessarily need to do that. But as long as there's somebody around trying to tell you what our history is, because I don't know anybody that I've talked to about the cool history of a building and they've been bored or not cared. You know, the more history you tell people, the more they get excited about it. And so, yeah, the building, the house, whatever it is, might look nondescript. It might not have a plaque in front, but as soon as you can tell them about some interesting factoid, it all of a sudden goes to something that we should preserve rather than demolish. And it becomes a piece of our fabric and it excites us. So yeah, little tidbits, informing the public. Yeah.
I think that's like an important point. Like, and that's something I try and like emphasize in my writing, is that like every building has a story. And even if that story is not told, like just because it's old and a little run down doesn't mean it should just be sent to the dump immediately. Like there's always something interesting to discover with these things. And having a demolition first mindset kind of does a disservice to kind of the history of these places, even if it is just boring. Like there's always something interesting lying beneath the surface. And even if you don't research it yourself, like it's something good to keep in mind. Like if you see an old house getting demolished and you think, oh, what does it matter? Just like, yeah, there's always something there that might be interesting and worthwhile.
Yeah. And I know that's, this is definitely something Corey is probably dealing with every day, but it's not always financially viable, right? And that's going to be the hardest thing. And that's why we do these kinds of things. And that's why we hope that people educate themselves and listen to society a bit more, is that, you know, that dollar value, even though it doesn't balance the pro forma, maybe magically like a developing on a greenfield site might, it's a much more important dollar. So yeah, I guess that's all I can hope for moving ahead.
I'm going to just add to that. And, like you said, Cody, sometimes it's not financially viable and you need grants and subsidies and help from the people that really push these views. If that be heritage preservation, like the City of Edmonton grants have been like why we can do these types of things. And if you want these things to continue, we need to have some sort of, I don't want to say incentive, but help to continue to do those things. And if you want to push an environmental standpoint, I think we'll see a lot more environmental grants saying that you need to do net zero in these retrofit projects, and having money subsidies for developers like Beljan or other people around the city, I think will really push the motive of what you want to achieve. So yeah, just wanted to say that as well.
Yeah, if I can jump in, I think that's a good point as well. Like, going back to what people can do, like as cliche as it sounds, like write your counselor. Like if you really care about heritage preservation, the city's heritage resource program is actually pretty good. And they I think it's up to 50% in some cases they'll cover total costs for restoration, at least of like the facade or whatever. But that's kind of an underfunded program. And yeah, if you really care about having buildings safe, even like writing to your counselor and suggesting like, or advocating for, you know, oh, more money should go towards this, more of my tax dollars should pay for like helping to preserve buildings, then that's something also you can do.
Yeah. Well, I think even recently with our elections, I think we've got a little bit more of a design focused council with urban planning backgrounds and other sorts of human oriented concerns. And so I think it's going to be really exciting to see what our Edmonton society does in tandem with our new exciting council. So with that, gentlemen, I think we can wrap up. I'm very pleased to have had this discussion. I know it's very easy to just get sad when a building's demolished and it's already too late. So it's really good to see what Beljan's doing in giving these buildings a facelift and giving them new life in their physical locations, and things like Dane, what you're up to. And it's just, it's not necessarily formal, but it's, you know, getting out there on social media and making these things fun and interesting and exciting, because then the more people care about it, the more people are going to listen and the more it's actually going to happen. So thank you both for your work that you do. And thanks for sitting down with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I mean, it kind of goes back to the conversation. Podcasts like this, Made and whatever, this continues and showcases what we're all passionate about. So kudos to you guys, and continue on what you guys are doing, because I know a lot of people love this podcast and listen to it. So yeah, great job.
Thank you, guys.
Special thanks on this episode to Jordan Ast for music, mixing, and mastering. The rest of the team includes Ankit Gongo, Tasina Ahmed, Cody Johnston, and myself, Stephanie Pollock. If this episode intrigued you, head over to your favorite podcast app and show us some love. If you want to learn more about MADE, who we are, what we're up to, and how you can help us out, head over to joinmade.org.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.